The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. The Vivaldi edition is a massive undertaking to record every composition by Antonio Vivaldi housed in the Biblioteca Nazionale in Turin, Italy. It was conceived by Italian musicologist Alberto Basso and the independent recording label Naive, and it has stretched out over nearly 20 years so far, with the 59th and 60th recordings in the series released in July 2019. Susan Orlando is the artistic director and the mastermind of the Vivaldi edition, and she has made time to chat with me via Skype about this important recording project. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's please start with the Turin archive itself. Would you explain what is contained in that archive and how it got there and why it is we don't really know this music?
All right, that's a lot of things to say all at one time, but I'll give it to you straight, as they say. When Vivaldi died in 1741, he was in Vienna, and he had debts in Venice. And so word of his death, when it got to Venice, his house would have been sealed off right away and an inventory made. And his brother and two sisters still lived in the family home. When they did the inventory, we have the document, there were no music manuscripts in the house and there were no musical instruments. What happened was that the brother sold them to a count. He got them out of there as soon as they learned of Antonio's death. They sold them to a count. That count ended up selling them to another count didn't have children and left this huge collection of music manuscripts to the family palace in Genova, Palazzo Balbo. And so this was what we're talking about here is Vivaldi's private library. Mm-hmm. It was his manuscript scores, handwritten autograph scores, because 100 concerti, more or less, were published in Amsterdam in his lifetime. He didn't keep those manuscripts because they were in print. But he was a prolific writer, and most of this music was never published. And so he kept copies of it. And he was commissioned to do a lot of music as well. In any case, it's a much longer and very convoluted kind of detective story how this this music got to Turin, but it ended up there. The library ended up buying it in 1930. And then one of the first people, interestingly, to try to catalog it was Ezra Pound, who was living in Rapallo. But one thing led to another. It was published by Ricordi in Italy, but never really distributed outside of Italy. And that was from between 1950 and 1970. They did publish all the instrumental music, but nobody knew about it. And so Ricordi stores had, you know, thousands of these scores, and until recently they were still available. But, you know, you had to rent the parts, and you only got the full score was very tiny. So anyways, it all ended up in Turin. And it was bought by a wealthy banker who had lost his young son, and then by a textile person who'd lost his. So they did, two different people put the money in to buy what is 450 works by Vivaldi. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about hundreds of concertos. There are 110 concertos just for violin alone. So 110 concertos, that must be 14 single CDs, more or less, or more. So there's all the instrumental music, because the concertos are for flute, they're for violin, obviously, for cello, for oboe, for bassoon, you know, which was a brand new instrument, and he wrote 39 concertos for bassoon. You know, so there are masses of instrumental music, for which he was very influential in the history of music. And then there are the operas that exist no place but in Turin, except for one that was found in Vienna. But all that music is in Torino, those operas. And then there's the sacred music, which is also only in Turin, principally in Turin. Mm. So, you know, that's what's there. And it's, you know, so much of it is music that hadn't been heard. You know, some of the principal things, like some of the sacred music, started being performed by English choirs, and then, you know, it was so fabulous, everybody started doing it. Yeah. But there's so much of that music had never been heard before.
Yeah, yeah. Did you personally have any particular surprises, any great stories or finds that, you know, that really just sort of blew you away personally?
As far as musically?
Yeah.
The whole thing is such an amazing find. Mm-hmm. It's for me that I've had this incredible luck for this project to fall into my lap. For me, it has just been I'm speechless, you know, when I think about this music, and that we could have never known this music. You know, yeah. One fire, it was gone. We would have never heard it. We had no idea how important Vivaldi was, how prolific he was. That amazes me more than anything, mm-hmm. is that this mm-hmm. man could have been overshadowed somehow and gone unrecognized until now. And when you start listening to this music, and because I work so closely with the orchestras and these manuscripts, I really know this music. So I'm now on my eighth violin. My next one will be the ninth concerto for violin. Mm. Now, you know, that's a lot of concertos if you consider that there's, you know, seven on each CD, six or seven on each CD. Mm-hmm. You'd think there would be a lot of repetition. Well, you know what? There's not. And I'll walk into a recording session and they'll be practicing and I'll say, oh, that must not be Vivaldi, because it's, you know, idioms and things that it doesn't sound like exactly like everything else I've heard by Vivaldi. And it will turn out that it is. I mean, his imagination had no ends. Yeah. No, you know, it was boundless.
Yeah. Now, you're a musician yourself. You're a viola da gamba player, right?
I am, yes. Yeah.
How'd you get involved in this project?
You know, Alberto Basso, I had with my husband, and I had a Baroque music festival in Northern Italy for 20 years. And so Alberto knew me because he's a very prominent musicologist. I think at that time he was in his 70s, and you know, we're talking in the 90s, 95 maybe. And he would come over, you know, to come to the festival. He'd come to our house for dinner. So he knew me. And my husband and I separated in 2000, and I ran into him in Turin. And I told him that, you know, I had moved to Turin for the moment because I was going to decide what to do with my life. And he immediately, within 2 weeks, asked me if I wanted to represent the Instituto per i Beni Musicali in Piemonte, which means the Institute for the Musical Cultural Heritage of Piedmont. So this institute's job, and he founded this office, if you want, it was to make catalogs of all the music inventories in Piedmont. Well, what's in the National Library in Turin is part of that. And so Alberto did one of the big catalogs on Vivaldi's music. So he knew what I was, that I was very organized, and that I speak a lot of languages, and that I know so many people in the Baroque music world, because I was a performer, because I had a festival, because I travel, and again, I speak everybody's language. So, you know, I speak fluent French and Italian, and I speak Portuguese. So the Portuguese didn't make much of a difference, but the French and Italian made a big difference. Yeah. And so he asked me if I wanted to represent them. Now, Alberto, it was the real genius in this project, because he had this idea. I asked him one day, I said, Alberto, how did you conceive of this? And he said, you know, I kept looking at that music. You know, he's a musician as well, so he could look at the music, he could see, you know, that it was extraordinary music. And he said, I just kept thinking, how can we bring this music to the public? Which, of course, was exactly the question to ask. You know, how do you get music that is on handwritten on a piece of paper is not really alive. Mm-hmm. It comes alive when you perform it. But when you perform a concert, which is fantastic, but it's ephemeral. There's nothing left afterwards. When you record this music, once it's recorded, it's out there to stay. Yeah. And it will be there, you know, forever. So, you know, he had this idea to record it all, and he found the means to put 80,000 euros a year into the project. So, of course, you know, for a record company, this was a very interesting proposal, not something they get every day. And he asked, that's how it started. And, you know, and at first, I thought I would do it as a part-time job. I was much more into 17th century music. Mm-hmm. And when I started hearing this music, I said, oh, my God, this is unbelievable stuff. And I just realized that, you know, maybe this is my destiny to do this, because I was and am in a position to take on this enormous project. And I just realized, you know, that how important it was to get this out there for people to have access to. Yeah. I mean, if it was mediocre music, I would never have put this much of my life and effort into something, but it's so extraordinary. Yeah. So that's the story, yeah. Basically.
Yeah. So you're really shining light on this otherwise hidden corner of Baroque music. And, you know, as you were saying, Vivaldi's really underrepresented and underappreciated in so many ways, and not as well known for anything but concertos. So you know, you really are not only illuminating his reputation, but also his repertory. But you say 450 pieces, and all I can think of is, oh, my God, where do you start? So could you talk? I mean, there's so many choices to be made. And I would like you to maybe sort of talk through the process of how you comb through this music, how you make decisions about which music to record next and which pieces to group together, because I noticed some unusual groupings. I'm not really sure what the process is behind it, the thought process is behind it, and even which performers that you employ to make these performances. Could you talk through those decisions?
Of course, I'd be happy to. So to start at the beginning of the question, how the music is chosen is very interesting, and it goes back once again to Alberto Basso. Alberto had this very brilliant idea to divide the music into 10 categories. And he divided it into the concerti for violin, the operas, the sacred music, the concerti for bassoon, because there's 39 of them, the concerti for multi-instrumenti, for several different instruments. So there are all these different categories, but he wanted each CD to only be from that category. Mm-hmm. Now, when I started, I said, Alberto, you know, this is going to be kind of boring for the public, you know, all bassoon concertos. And of course, the musicians all said the same thing, because that was our mind frame. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2000, that was the way everybody thought. You don't do a record that's just concerti for one instrument. You know, you'd make something with variety. Mm-hmm. What I've realized now is that it was a brilliant idea, because we've put out now 62 CDs. If those CDs were all mixed bags, a little bit of everything, it would not have the impact on people that it has to realize, oh my God, another volume of violin concerti, another volume of, you know, suddenly people are saying this man was prolific, you know, and they sit up and pay attention. So, you know, that means, so I've already got that category is divided, so that helps. Now, with the violin concerti, because there are 110 and that's so many, I've worked with musicologists who know this music very well as well, and we've divided it into categories, into programs with a title. Now, sometimes it's very vague, you know, concerti per il castello, for the castle. You know, that this is something that's going to be released in the fall. That title is only because those things were written for a count who lived in a castle in Bohemia, and so we imagine that that's where the music, we know the music ended up there. And it was commissioned for Vivaldi. But it's, you know, it's a vague title, doesn't mean much. Mm. Whereas Concerti per Anna Maria was a violinist at the orphanage where Vivaldi taught. And she was one of the great virtuosic violin players in Europe at the time. So, you know, that's more specific. But it already, you know, I've got, you know, those programs worked out. And for the other CDs, you know, I work it out between musicologists, listening to the music. You know, a lot of times I'll go see what has been recorded and listen to it to get an idea. I work with the musicians as well. We put together a program, and that's how we do those. Now, the operas obviously are already decided. The sacred music also, it depends on whether you need a choir, whether it's for a soprano solo, you know, so there are a lot of things to dictate how you divide this music up. But the important thing is that it's always in one of these categories. Mm-hmm. As far as the choosing the artist for the Vivaldi edition, people have often asked me why it's always Italian musicians. And I have this philosophy. A lot of this music has not been heard since the 18th century. And to me, in my mind, if this first recording is by people who are at the cutting edge of this music, who are steeped in this music because they've been doing it for years and they've given an enormous amount of thought and it's just in their blood. You know, you're going to have a role model for people who are listening to it for the first time of the highest standard. And then, you know, once this music's out there, everybody's going to start playing it. Mm-hmm. But I just, the idea is to get a really fine example, because we still continue to learn so much about historical performance techniques in Baroque music. You know, I see myself how much it's evolved in the last 30 years. It's pretty mind-boggling, and it's also evolved, you know, a great deal in the last 10 years. So it's, you know, that's not going to end. Mm. And I see it in the recordings as well. So I pick these musicians who I know are some of the very best people in interpreting this music. You listen to Ottavio Dantone, you know, and the way he, the variations he writes, for example, in the music. People today weren't doing a lot of variations, writing, you know, what might have been at the time in the 18th century an improvised section in the music. But Ottavio is a great master to follow in this because he's absolutely brilliant. And he knows this repertoire and the performance practices of in Italy in the 18th century better than anybody I know. He's not the only one. Fabio Biondi's another, you know, but all these people that I use are those kind at that level people. The singers, you know, there was a stock group of singers that we used a lot because they were, you know, when we started, singers with very agile voices, you know, all wanted to be part of this because it's such a showcase for somebody who has an agile voice because of the da capo arias, because they're in the repeat, there are all these variations on the first part of the aria where you can really, you know, in the 18th century, you would improvise all over the place. Mm-hmm. That's when people stopped talking and sat up to listen. Let's hear what he or she's going to do in the da capo, you know, because it could be like fireworks, and it often is. So a lot of these people came to me then, and you know, we're already doing Baroque music, so Sara Mingardo and Sandrine Pio, just so many of them. I'm trying to think. There's just a lot of different names. But Sonia Prina is another one who worked a lot with us. Topi Leti Pu. It goes on and on for the operas because we've done 17 of them. But what now? You know, it's funny. After 15 years, I see that I'm now turning my attention, as are the conductors, to some of the younger generation, because we use the same people for a long time. But now, you know, there's a whole younger generation coming up with these, you know, these very fresh voices, as opposed to the beauty of a mature voice.
Yeah.
But the voice, of course, when they're young, the voice is not anywhere near as mature, and maybe can't always get the depth of character. But they have this fresh agility that is so lovely, depending on the part. But it's often you need those kind of voices. So choosing the artist has been very much thought about, and you know, I will be bringing out some new artists too, that, you know, we'll be bringing out some artists that people haven't heard, you know, before, and again, in bringing out some of the newer people that are on the scene in Italy, mm-hmm. and in Europe in general.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to something that I wanted to ask you about, so I want to, before I get off this topic, it's sort of related, but this project really, it has been continuing on for so long, and a lot has changed in the world, not only in Baroque music and performance practice, as you mentioned, but also even things like the technology, you know, just the recording technology and the business of recording and releasing performances. All of these things have changed quite dramatically. And I'm wondering whether there have been any particular advantages or any particular challenges that you've experienced with this project as that landscape has evolved over the years.
Well, the biggest challenge concerning the change in the whole music listening process today is that there's a substantial number of people who collect this Vivaldi edition, and they're very attached to CDs. Mm-hmm. So if everybody does streaming, you don't have a physical mm-hmm. object anymore. Mm-hmm. You also don't have a physical object you can give to people. Mm-hmm. But I have been ranting for quite a while now with the record companies and the platforms about the fact that it's all based on a pop music or, you know, a popular music idiom. Mm. And the needs for recorded music by pop musicians is not the same as for classical musicians. People who listen to Baroque and classical music often want to read about the context. Mm-hmm. And they also want to know who's performing and their biographies and all mm-hmm. the rest of it. Yeah. And so I've been saying for quite a while, you've got to get the booklets on there.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to say that Cobuz, which is just launched in America, which is a French music streaming platform, they've got all the Vivaldi CDs and they've got all the booklets right there. You can click right on them, read the whole thing. So it's starting to happen, but that's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, and you raise a really good point. I mean, pop music is by definition going to be more fleeting, unlike classics, things that are lasting.
It brings me to another thought, which is, you know, what is streaming going to do to the way we listen to Baroque and classical music? When all you're listening to is one movement of a concerto, the concertos mm-hmm. were always in three movements, mm-hmm. and suddenly all that counts is, you know, I haven't mm-hmm. thought this through yet. I don't have the answer. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a good thing. I don't know. But you can't help but recognize the fact that, you know, it's dissecting music. And, yeah. you know, if we're not careful, we may get to a point where we only listen to bits and pieces of things.
Yeah. Yeah. This is another perfect jumping off point, though, too, because you talk about classical music lovers and Baroque music lovers really liking that tactile thing, you know, having the CD in hand. And one of the many very striking aspects of the Vivaldi edition is the CD art, those very distinctive photographs on each of the CDs. Would you talk a little bit about that, how you choose those unusual and very striking photographs?
So when the Vivaldi edition started up, the head of the classical music department, Hervé Boissière, had this brilliant idea, which was to engage a quite well-known photographer in Paris by the name of Denis Rouvre to do the cover photos. And so Denis Rouvre does a lot of portraits of people, of famous actors and people like that. And he's very, very creative. So basically what happened then and what happens today, if I'm doing an opera for every one of these recordings, is that we tell René Rouve a little bit about the CD, what it is. So if I said, to go back to the example of the Concerti per il Castello, if we're talking about a castle in Bohemia, you know, this is going to inspire his mind. So he will, all his models, he gets off the street. These aren't, you know, famous models, and he dresses them up, you know, but it's almost always from the bust line up. And it's mostly women. There are five or six that covers that are men, but they're beautifully photographed in color. And, you know, we were very much criticized in the beginning, vehemently by some people, for doing these modern looking photographs. And we persisted, and I'm so glad we did, because first of all, it was great for marketing, because there were still record stores, and people would go in. If you had two of these CDs, you knew it was fantastic music. All you needed to do was see another one of these photographs that would just jump out of you in the record stores, and you'd say, "Oh, I've already got two of those records. They're fantastic," and you'd buy it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was a really good thing. And I also think too, because so many people who have never listened to Baroque music will see, you know, "Oh, it's Baroque music. I'm not interested in that," because it's something from too far in the past. You know, they've never approached it. And by putting something so modern on the cover and so eye-catching, I think that it's won over some people who've given it a try who might not have otherwise.
Yeah, I love that. And I wholeheartedly agree. They do. They're very fresh. They're very modern. They're very quirky in a way. They're also quite strikingly beautiful. I've always wondered what that was all about. So that's a great story. And I think it's brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah, this has really become a labor of love for you, hasn't it?
It is very much a passion and a labor of love. Yeah. It's sort of my life work. You know, it just fell in my lap, and it is really just, you know, I can't say it enough. It's so extraordinary. And I know that, you know, not everybody would be in a position to do it, you know, to get this out and to promote it in several countries and to do conferences and, you know, just get it out there. I mean, it's a driving passion. Absolutely. Yeah.
So a lot of the music Vivaldi was composing was for these young women, very talented young women, in many cases handpicked, really, to study with him and to work with him in this orchestra at the Pietà. Could you talk a little bit about how that ties into the Vivaldi edition?
Well, most of this music, a great part of it, was written for the orchestra at La Pietà. La Pietà was in a foundling hospital, so like an orphanage. At the time that Vivaldi started teaching violin there, it was in 1703. There were 700 girls there in this foundling hospital. Now, what they had been doing for decades was that they would pick out, and there were four of these, they called them ospedali. There were four of them in Venice, and they all put on concerts on the weekends for nobility and the aristocrats, and drew, you know, audiences, but it also put them in competition. What they would do at the Pietà is that the girls who showed a talent for music when they were little would be taken apart. They would have a better regime of food. They would get to sleep longer. And they started being trained to be musicians. So the Pietà hired very fine musicians like Vivaldi to come in and teach. They had always somebody very fine to write the music for the orchestra and for the choir. And Vivaldi ended up evolving from a violin teacher there to the person conducting and writing most of the music for this orchestra. And these girls had nothing else in their lives but this music. And so, of course, they threw themselves into it. But because that's what they did all day long, and because I think, too, it was such a great thing for somebody with nothing in their life and living in a kind of a convent-type regime, to have the joy of playing this music, which in itself is so deeply embedded with a joie de vivre, it had to have been something really great for these young girls. I just, I often think about when you listen to this music, what it had to have been to perform it when you had nothing in your life but the admiration of all this royalty down there. The reason the Ospedale did this to these concerts is because it was a way of getting donations to help, which would help cover the costs of these institutions. And so most of Vivaldi's music was written for that, for the Pietà, and for these great, the great orchestra, the choir, and the soloist. The operas, now, very few people know this, but Vivaldi, this was a time when 18th century opera was exploding, and there was a great demand for it, so you could write operas, you know, by the foot, if you want. Vivaldi claims in a letter at the end of his life that he wrote over 90 operas. We have the music, that we have the librettos for 50. We have the music for about 19 or 20 of them, not more. So, and he and his father were the impresarios, so the directors of a opera theater. There were six of them in Venice at the time, called Sant'Angelo, Teatro Sant'Angelo. And so that meant that they basically put together a program for each season, picked the groups they wanted, the operas they wanted, but there was always one of Vivaldi's operas in each of these seasons. And so, you know, a lot of his works were performed there, but they also were being performed all over Europe. So, you know, because he was quite well known. So, and this is very unique. One unique thing about Vivaldi is that he wrote both instrumental, sacred music, and operatic music. I don't think any other 18th century composer, I don't know of any other 18th century composer who wrote in all three of these categories. Wrote in two, but nobody that I know of in three. I also think that the collection of music manuscripts in Turin is the most complete collection of autographed manuscripts intact that we have of an 18th century composer. We put together Handel, we put together box works, but this music, you know, traditionally and was always dispersed when somebody died, especially when they were well known. And so, you know, it's just a fluke that it's come down to us, this great archive of music by Vivaldi.
So what do we still have to look forward to in the series coming up? What highlights or what little special nuggets or tidbits do you want to reveal right now that we can look forward to?
Well, let's see. We've got a wonderful CD of the third volume of cello concerti by Christophe Coin, the cellist who did the first two and who's an absolute poet. And I've heard the master. It's being printed as we speak, and it's pretty fabulous. There's another CD of violin concerti with Académie Byzantine and Alessandro Tampieri as the soloist. That is stunning as well. I just happened to recently have listened to the masters for all these things. I'm doing an opera with Fabio Biondi in October. We're recording it in October. It'll come out in the spring, called Argipo. Now, Argipo is an example of an opera that is not in Turin. This pasticcio opera was found in Regensburg in 2008 or 9. And then they found in 2011 another copy of it but with a lot of changes in Darmstadt. And then there seems to be a score or libretto in Prague. In any case, it turns out that this was an opera, a good part of it is by Vivaldi, and it'll all the recitative, I believe he wrote. It's music that was being used by traveling Italian opera companies in the 18th century. And for musicologists, looking at these different scores and seeing how it was transformed from, you know, one place and to the next, we start understanding a lot of things we didn't know before about traveling opera companies in the 18th century. So it's pretty exciting. It's a short opera. It's two CDs. So I'm looking very much forward to this because this is a real discovery.
Well, I'm looking forward to it too. Susan Orlando is the artistic director of the Vivaldi edition on the independent recording label Naive. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.